Hello all, and welcome to Book Spider, a podcast for book nerds who like to wash their dishes to the soundtrack of intellectual despair. My name is Chris Malmberg, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. Today, we're closing out our discussion of Roberto Bolaño's novel 2666, specifically parts 4, the part about the crimes, and part 5, the part about Arkham Baldi. Definitely listen to those other episodes if you haven't already. The part about the crimes is probably what this book is and is known for and will be known for, for as long as this book is remembered. It's a braided narrative following various members of the Santa Teresa police force, some prisoners, some journalists, an FBI consultant, a congresswoman, a collectively elected seer, and a hulking enigmatic European immigrant held under suspicion of being a serial killer of girls and women. But most significantly, this is the part about the crimes, and it contains perhaps 100 individual accounts of the murders and discovered bodies of women, what was done to them or what is suspected to have been done to them. Meanwhile, the police arrest and imprison various men for the crimes, but ultimately work in service of a corrupt system that perpetuates this violence toward women. The part resolves not by resolving really anything, that any plot points that are brought up in the part about the crimes, but it does, at least in my view, gesture into a kind of bringing into resolution some of the scope of the problem. The part about Arkham Baldi, the fifth and final part of 2666, is the biggest tonal jump in the novel. For me anyway, it was. It seems almost whimsical at times. Suddenly we're in the years following World War I, tracing the life of a German boy named Hans Rieder. It turns out, is Arkham Baldi before he took on the pseudonym. We watch him grow up, develop obsessions for the seafloor and seaweed and books, and get pulled into World War II and kill a simpering Nazi bureaucrat in an Allied prison camp. Then Rieder becomes Arkham Baldi, the writer, and we get a portrait of the artist up through his 80s when he sets out on behalf of his sister to Mexico. It turns out her son, his nephew, is Klaus Haas, the giant European emigrant of the previous part about the crimes, imprisoned under suspicion of at least some of the murders in Santa Teresa. And the novel ends at that point. We never really get to Santa Teresa with Arkham Baldi. So I'm going to talk about the ask questions about the parts in succession a little bit, but then also want to talk about the novel as a whole. First, the part about the crimes. It does seem stylistically significant that we are just inundated with so many of these pretty clinically recounted murder scenes and scenes of discovering bodies and of the investigations into these dead women. What is the effect of reading about all of these crimes and the part about the crimes? Did it make you feel a certain way? Numb, complicit, bored? Does it feel like there is a craft intent there, and is it successful? So how did it make you feel, and is it successful?
Well, it definitely this time made me feel a bit older, in the sense that I feel like my defenses are a bit lower than they were 15 years ago, you know, when I first read this and when I wrote about it for my thesis in grad school. I remember not really kind of having a thick enough skin then that it just didn't really, because it is such clinical language, I feel like it at the time didn't really penetrate in a way when I was 28, you know, and I do remember just kind of feeling there is a level of kind of depression that you get from the restatement and restatement and restatement and the kind of the ways that certain phrases recur and just the kind of, I guess, horror of it, for lack of any more articulate way to put it. And I found myself this time, I think, more affected by that, not really in any kind of way other than just, you know, sadness and a vague kind of sickness. Not so much so that I found it impossible to read, but enough so that it was definitely like, yeah, a lot. It's funny because a lot of this section, I still find like the parts that are not descriptions of the body of a murdered woman, I actually still find surprisingly funny and intriguing and amusing. And there is, I don't want to say a lightness to them, but definitely they're readable in a certain way. And then when, you know, the description of the murder scene comes again, it's just like, oh, fuck, another one. And I suppose that kind of, oh, fuck, another one is fundamentally is what you're meant to get, right? So it's effective in that regard. I think that I don't have these exact numbers in front of me, but I believe that I counted, and I back when I was writing about this in my 20s, I counted. I think there are 107 murders of women and girls mentioned in the novel, described in the novel, and I believe that that corresponds exactly to the number that actually occurred in the real city of Juarez during the time. That was that, like, if you look up like a list of the femicides in that area, as it was used, you know, by activists who were protesting the impunity of the murders, I think the numbers correspond precisely, and so it definitely feels like. I mean, it's craft-wise really a pretty simple technique, I suppose, right? But just kind of like deliberately making the reader sort of live in the awfulness of this in a very unflinching way. Maybe even sort of an artless way in a way. But yeah, I mean, I think just kind of the fundamental horror of it, I did find both. I mean, because it you know, you don't, I guess you don't have the normal comfort of, well, this is just fiction that you would with a lot of things, right? Because it's essentially like as close to literal fact as anything you're going to encounter in a novel. And that's yeah, just upsetting in a pretty basic way. And I suppose a lot to ask of a reader when you already have something this long and sprawling and in some ways disorganized. Although, you know, I think I said in the first episode that it is both a disorganized, strange, sometimes very thematically confusing or meandering novel that at the same time makes its point with the sledgehammer, right? And this is really where you get into the sledgehammer. So I wonder, you have mentioned to me that you were dreading this part. And I know that when we read this in our 20s, my memory of it is that you kind of almost stopped reading the novel here, like you barely got through it. And I know that you, at that time, I remember feeling like you were more sensitive to things like this in fiction than I am. I suppose time has kind of made me catch up to you in that regard. But how was it coming back to it for you?
Yeah, for sure. When I first read it, I had a hard time getting through it. This time was not any easier. Maybe it was even worse, but I had an obligation kind of to get through it. I had to stop, you know, a few times this time. And I you know, one of the things that I experienced going through it was just kind of confusion around names, because there's so many of them, right? You have just this onslaught of dead people and the people that they're connected to, and the ongoing ongoing investigations that some of them have, many of them really pretty much effectively go uninvestigated. And, you know, circling back on gang members and this or that person, or, you know, the police trying to convict the guilty party in some new femicide for a previous femicide. There is this like kind of wall of red thread, and you know, it's all just sort of scattered in the end in my brain, like the connections between these different people, and there's a kind of a numbness that comes with that, I think. you know, just at least it was for me, like a difficulty in keeping track of the individual lives that were affected and all of it sort of receding into this painful ambient despair that, you know, maybe like mimics that the kind of helplessness of being in Santa Teresa through this period. You know, what is another dead woman when there's already been 84 of them or more? And so, I did not have an easier time. I think I had a worse time. Patrick, you had some thoughts that you were going to share about the experience of all of the of reading about all of these femicides in this novel, in this part.
Well, you initially described the account as clinical, which I think is a good word. I think that when I was going through this part, part four, the part about the crimes, the word I had in my head was journalistic, but I assume we're kind of talking about the same thing. Like when the recounting of the femicides is journalistic in that, or clinical in that it seems to concisely list, the novel seems to concisely list the details of the crime, you know, like over and over, the repetition of anally and vaginally raped, presence of semen, you know, and like it's all horrifying. For me, I guess it's like the litany that makes it so horrifying, right? Like the fact that it's over and over and over and relentless and unending. Now when you get into some of the like more, the less journalistic aspect where you're talking about some of the detectives, Juan
Didios Martinez.
Yeah. What was his, how do you say his middle names?
Didios?
Vidios Martinez, Juan Martinez, and his relationship with the director. That felt more fictional, more like, you know, getting into characters' backstories. And then, you know, Klaus being in prison, that was horrifying as well, but not in the same like journalistic way, because it was more like hot-blooded, I guess, you know, if that makes sense. But yeah, I mean horrifying. Yes, horrified.
Yeah, the stories that take place in prison. You know, this is an interesting reflection, and you just made me think about it, because the femicides did not, they lived rent-free in my head, but not like any particular one, right? It's like just the onslaught of them, the being mobbed by horror. And I already feel that to be the case, you know, like having read it so recently, it's like, it's just really hard to hold them in your brain. But the violence in prison is so like, purely and distinctly and kind of even sort of funny and weird and disturbing. Farfán and Gomez in their sort of mutual like rape relationship.
Right. Like the one rapes the other and then it's like, okay, he's like,
your turn
to do me because
it's only fair.
Like, wow.
I know.
It's only fair if, like, we're going to still be friends. You have to be able to do it to me, right?
Yeah. And Klaus inserts a knife up a man's anus. Yeah. And then that, probably, but the one that really stuck out is just slitting the scrotums of the gang members and just milking is the word, out the testicles.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, all of that is incredibly grotesquely personal and intimate and singular and cinematic, maybe is one way of putting it. But like the others, the women are like a very indistinct vibe. Yeah. And that feels like Bolaño knows what he's doing. Like, that's one thing. Like, this book is, you mentioned, messy, Hans, but it's incredibly intentional at the same time. Like, it feels extraordinarily intentional to me. And so, you know, that may or may not be like a conscious choice, you know, on his part, but it's definitely, it feels like a resonance that, like, he's conscious of, and that really, you know, plays into the themes of the novel.
That they're not allowed to be characters. That the women who are killed, the people who are killed in prison at least have the, I mean, they might die in very, very undignified ways, but they have in some sense the dignity of being characters who live with kind of agency and vitality and who suffer in the present tense. And the women are simply, they're facts in a way. They're objectified in a sense, right? Not in the sexual sense we would normally think of the word objectified, but they are in some sense rendered into spare facts that contain no life. Which I think has to be to some extent meant to sort of recapitulate the ways in which the whole system and world that they live in deprives them of kind of personhood and agency, right? Like the murder, it kind of being the logical endpoint of that, but you know, the sexism and the economic exploitation and all these things kind of, the craft choice to kind of make this distinction between these like cinematic, characterful murders and violences and these sort of spare, clinical, emotionally evacuated violences, murders, seems, I think, more or less intentional, maybe, but certainly impactful.
Now, if we jump to the part about Arcambaldi, and I feel like I'm, there's no way to not rush this episode, but I feel like we kind of have to do three things. We kind of have to talk about the part about the crimes. We have to talk about the part about Arcambaldi, and we have to talk about the book as a whole a little bit. I must admit I was thrown quite a bit this time by the jump in tone, by the kind of shift in focus. And, you know, is it simplistic of me? You know, maybe I'm grasping at the simple things, or maybe this is a reflection of like the hitting the themes like very overtly and somehow getting away with it. But is it wrong of me to draw the kind of explicit connection between the femicides in Santa Teresa and you know, the Holocaust? It does feel like there is, you know, a very important but off-screen moment. Like, we're off-screen. I'm going back to cinematic language, but we don't really see Reeder kill. Is it Sammer, the German bureaucrat? But that feels extraordinarily important, and there is a way in which Sammer's story about, you know, more or less for bureaucratic and somehow worse. I don't know if it's worse, but like Sammer's relationship to the murders, to the deaths of these Jews that he was, you know, put in charge of, is not vindictive. It's not, even like patriotic, not ideologically driven. Yes, exactly. Thank you for helping me with that. And so there's something in that, you know, I kind of went back to this problem, the systemic issues in Santa Teresa that are also, you know, embedded in bureaucracy and corruption and the way in which it's allowed to perpetuate because, you know, it's just so difficult. The problem is so multi, you know, it's like eight dimensional, right? It's got threads in so many things, in the maquiladores, the factories where things are produced, the gang presence, the relationship of gangs and maquiladores to politics. And so when Sammer's story really zeroed in for me on the bureaucratic momentum that pushed Sammer to, you know, kill these people, you know, that felt resonant to me. Is that a simplistic connection? Is there more? Would either of you carry that in different directions? And how can we use maybe part four to understand a little bit more about part five?
I mean, I don't think that that's oversimplified at all. No, and I don't think it's unfair to... I think it's an oversimplification to say that the book compares the femicides to the Holocaust, right? But I think that I do think that there is meant to be certainly a resonance between Sommer's story and the ways in which power functions in Santa Teresa. I mean, I think that when I wrote about this in school, I compared it to The Banality of Evil by Hannah Arendt, right? Like I kind of pulled that in as a real life example to help understand both of these things. That the, you know, what you have in the case of Sommer is this character who is this unassuming middle level bureaucrat carrying out evil for reasons that really ultimately, I think, boil down to just such a lack of vision and courage that he has a complete failure to understand that he lacks vision and courage, right? That you have this incredibly... In Germany, you have the force of anti-Semitism, and kind of like the paranoid worldview connected to anti-Semitism. In Santa Teresa, you have the force of deeply entrenched misogyny, and in the cases of both Sommer and many of the people in power in Santa Teresa, you have people in a corrupt environment with just absolutely no vision, no courage, being kind of carried along into evil by the tide of either anti-Semitism or deeply entrenched misogyny, and participating in it without understanding in any way their own evil, right? And, I mean, obviously the Holocaust is... A bigger deal than the femicides, I suppose, for lack of any more articulate way to put it. But I mean, I think that like the fundamental structure of this sort of malevolent cultural force combined with bureaucrats and lazy people who are in positions that should be power but who don't understand how to use those, the forces that get us from point A to point B and the people who are stuck in the middle of that, I think the parallel, I think, is very, very clear.
Patrick, I'm curious your thoughts on that, and also your thoughts on kind of getting through this novel to part five, getting through part four to part five, because I'll admit part five is a little bit occluded, you know, for me, in behind the massive, horrific, like, experience of part four. And, I don't know, what was your sense of reading the part about Arkham Baldi? And does it sort of stand out for you, or is it similarly like kind of overshadowed? I'm not saying it's lesser than. I'm honestly like, I'm thinking about it now. Like, I wonder about reading these backwards and trying to like, sort of maybe that changes my relationship to the different parts. But Patrick, what is your sense of the like connections between part four and part five? And how are you feeling about part five in general?
Well, I would like to say, like, I see what Hans is saying, that like the banality of evil is like the combining element between parts four and part five. But I honestly, and I'm not saying this to say that Hans is wrong. I don't think that I have grasped the connection between the two parts enough to say that Hans is wrong. It's just upon first read, what Hans just said about like the similarity between the Holocaust in terms of structure, obviously not size, like 107 women versus, you know, 6 million Jews. It's not the same. It's not at the same scale. But in terms of structure, I don't quite see what's happening. So to my understanding, the banality of evil points at someone like Adolf Eichmann, who is tasked with coming up with the final solution. To, you know, what's our solution for all these Jews that we don't want to be in Germany? Well, his solution is, well, you know, and Eichmann entertained a few different ideas. One was like exile to some other place, you know, and so he ultimately comes up, well, I guess we have to exterminate them, you know, like, oh, it's the choice, you know. And so in the case of the Holocaust, the banality of evil strikes me as a person, a group of people who lack any moral agency whatsoever and simply follow the bureaucratic process to its ending. Now, I think, Hans, you did use the word bureaucracy, right? So it's like just being part of a mechanism leads to genocide, and the people who are part of that mechanism not willing to they are not willing to imagine themselves outside of that mechanism or as having any causal agency within that mechanism. So I definitely see that in the Holocaust. What I didn't quite see is that going on in Santa Teresa. You guys have talked about like there's power, there's corruption, and there is corruption going on, but the moment that seemed characteristic to me of what was going on in Santa Teresa was they send some semen samples off for matching, and it gets lost. And then they do it again, and it gets lost. It like gets lost a couple times, right? And that strikes me as a little different than the description of the Holocaust we've just talked about. That is more like neglect and inattention. Like, if you wanted, if you were working hard enough, if you cared enough, you could get those semen samples and figure it out, right? So I don't know, that's my first impression. My first impression is that the fundamental problem of Santa Teresa is apathy, whereas the fundamental problem of the Holocaust is lack of moral agency. And maybe those aren't mutually exclusive at all. They're probably not. And there's probably like a more complex answer that I think Hans would give, or you would give, Chris. But that was my initial reaction. And so I didn't quite see the connection between 4 and 5 in that way. Like I didn't necessarily see World War II and what's happening in Santa Teresa as kind of the same thing. Like I would say I'm pretty stumped on how those two fit together, on how the whole thing fits together, to be honest. Other than the overlapping characters, I wasn't sure.
Well, the apathy comes from a lack of moral agency, right? I mean, if you characterize the Holocaust as being a lack of moral agency, like most of the police, most of the civil servants, the mayor, like, it's not explicitly stated, but my sense is that on some level, these people all know roughly who's doing it, and they're too scared to do anything about it, and B, they are deeply misogynistic, right? Like, there's this long scene of all the cops telling jokes about women. I mean, I think...
I remember that. That was a super strong part, I thought. Like,
I don't think, and again, like, how much in the real world this is all, how fair this is in the real world, I don't know, right? Like, but I mean, I guess my sense is that the partly, like, there's a suggestion there, I think, that, like, the level of misogyny in Santa Teresa is maybe not that different in a way from, like, the level of anti-Semitism in Germany, right? That those deep-seated forces of bigotry are equivalent, right? And the combination of the lack of moral agency plus that bigotry is causing the reason. It's not just that the semen samples get lost, right? It's like there's, and again, it's not signposted as clearly as you might think it would be, and I don't have the list in front of me here, but there's so many references to, like, well, they could have gone and checked this out, but they didn't. They could have done this with the crime scene, but they didn't. Nobody really thought to interview this person. And again, I mean, yeah, I think, like, if you define, I guess, like, the only thing I'd really say, this isn't such a complex argument at all, I suppose, but if you define the banality of evil as being the lack of moral agency in a system that is faced with a big problem, a big moral problem, then, I mean, I think the lack of moral agency is all over the Santa Teresa section.
Well, I think I would, all I would say is that apathy seems like a big thing in Santa Teresa, but I don't see apathy in the Holocaust. In fact, I think they lacked moral agency because they couldn't imagine themselves outside of the system. But a lot of people were very fervent in executing the dictates of that system. Like, we have a lot of people who, you know, were happy to kill Jews. So I don't know if the... Again,
that's extra textual, you know? And I mean, a part of the issue might be, like the fervent killers of Jews are not in the book, right? You could just as easily... I mean... My understanding is actually, like, the rate of uncleared murders of women in the real life Juarez was not actually that much higher or that anomalous relative to like most developed Mexican cities of the time, right? Like,
right,
the idea of the femicides being some uniquely Juarezian and uniquely monstrous thing, my understanding is that's not really numerically true, right? And in fact, like, at the time that that was occurring, at the time it was occurring, there were actually, you know, like in America at that time, and these numbers are all recalled vaguely from 15 years ago, so some room for error here. But my understanding is, like, in America at that time, the murder ratio of men to women was like, I think 3 to 1, right? Like 3 men were murdered for 1 woman. And in Mexico, it was 10 to 1. 10 men were murdered for 1 woman. So there was actually like, I think like you have to kind of, in both these cases, I think, let go of some of the extra textuals to get the theme, you know? There aren't, I know that there were very enthusiastic killers of Jews in Nazi Germany, but those are not present here, right? And I don't mean to like, and that's, I understand that like you can't, I totally understand that you can't not have those things in your mind when you're reading, right? But I and this is maybe a critique actually of the book, right? You have to like, I think if you are too deeply rooted in the history of either of these things, there are plenty of ways to see factual, to kind of take factual issue with how things are presented. And maybe that's even a rebuttal to your point. It's just something that is probably worth thinking about in how we think about how these.
I think that's a good point. Like to say that, like, the intention is to compare the blatant anti-Semitism of World War II Europe with Germany, the blatant anti-Semitism of World War II Europe and Germany with the blatant misogyny and homophobia of Santa Teresa in the 90s. Like, that seems good to me. So like, I think that's fine to say that, that's the intent of the book. And if we delve too much into that extra textual stuff, we will begin to see dissimilarities. So, and that's fine. Like, and as I said, I'm not really, I don't think you're wrong, Hans. I think that I didn't quite see what you were saying. That's all. That's all, really.
Sure.
It seemed dissimilar in certain ways.
Yeah, it's totally fair to find it. I mean, I think like it's totally fair to find it unpersuasive as a diagnosis. And I do think that it's, if you want to read the book as being like femicides equals Holocaust, I think that's a very hard thing to support, right? And you have to kind of get to a pretty decent level of abstraction to reach that point. I think you kind of have to at least kind of allow the question of reading it that way because it is so, you know, present. But
right,
yeah. I do agree that, I mean, the difference in scale, I think, is
right.
If it were not framed the way that it is, which is, you know, the experience we have of the Holocaust is really just this one village, then I think the difference in scale would kind of make the point to some extent irrelevant.
Well, and the village itself, the murder of these Jews in this village is not actually reflective of how so many were murdered. I'm sure many were murdered this way, but actually this is an example of the state trying to kind of hide the crime from itself. Like it's, you know, Sommer's put in this position of having to take care of these people with no support or actual infrastructural desire that those people be taken care of. And so it's just basically told to him to figure it out and just hinted at strongly that you know, they need to be disposed of. Or maybe they say that exactly, actually. But it's not, you know, gas chambers and mechanized genocide. It is actually, you know, we're getting an example here of you know, it comes up a few times, but an invisible or an intended to be invisible crime, you know, hidden from the mechanisms that make it possible, or at least there's an attempt to make it hidden. But it's not, you know, like, you know, I feel this is maybe where I get a little bit stuck, because the part about Archimbaldi is not really solely, you know, about this. And so I'm a little bit lost, and maybe Hans, you do have, I think, the sort of strongest relationship to this novel. Can you help me understand, what the rest of the part about Archimbaldi is doing, like the parts about writing, about a writer's life? Is there, you know, or is that just something, a relationship that I should build in another read through, which I'm happy to do, because I do really fucking adore this novel as a whole. I think, like you said, Hans, part four is strangely funny at times. You know, the long pile of really grotesque jokes about women, notwithstanding. I didn't find that necessarily funny, but it is really fucking funny sometimes. And part five is even fucking funnier. I don't know. Like, I loved part five. I just don't know what to do with it. And so close and following part four, I'm struggling a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have a great answer for you. I think when I read it and wrote about it in the past, the Sommer scene really eclipsed a lot, really any level of analysis of the rest of part five, right? So I don't have a stock answer from my past self. And I don't know necessarily, I mean, the thoughts about a writer's life, the thoughts about the nature of literature, I don't even know that I could tell you off the top of my head exactly what it's saying about a writer's life or the nature of writing. I don't know that it's necessarily trying to say anything generalizable, right? It's very much the story of an individual and an individual experience, and how a particular kind of aesthetic and emotional relationship to literature are formed. Although we don't have that great a sense really of what Archimbaldi's style is or what type of thing he is writing, right? I think to some extent, like, I don't know that in a lot of ways it seems to me, at least on this read, on this consideration, other than the Sommer scene and the communist writers, those two kind of nested narratives, probably feels like the least thematic of the bunch, right? And I guess it is interesting to think about it in relationship to part one, right? Because in part five, well, in part one, I think we talked a bit when we discussed part one about, like, whether or not these critics and the world that they exist in and the kind of academy that they serve, whether that has any, whether that is serving anything authentic, right? Whether that has any real values, whether that contributes anything, or whether it is kind of ultimately a vehicle for mostly just for, like, ego and personal competition and advancement and kind of getting to get paid to not have a real job, you know? And I don't think that it comes out of that, you know, part one, I don't think comes, it doesn't seem to me to be particularly kind to the critics, the academy, their relationship to the work, right? They're kind of parasites to some extent. And there's a sort of heart and truth in part five that you see in Archimbaldi's life and person that presumably is reflected in the work, right? Like, we get the sense that the work is valuable and legitimate and true and real. And I think the contrast between parts 1 and 5 in that regard are telling, right? Between the kind of truth and heart of Archimboldi in his life and that we assume is in his work, and the kind of these critics who are actually like this sort of cynical, like remoras on a shark, you know? And we talked a little bit in part 1 about in the end of the sequence in Juarez, or sorry, in Santa Teresa rather, when the critics, you know, they get the email from Liz that she's not going to date either one of them, Pelletier or the Espinosa. And Espinosa's way of coping is to go, you know, kind of prey on a teenager. And Pelletier's way of coping is to truly bury himself in Archimboldi. And I wonder if, having been back through part 5, the decision of Pelletier to bury himself in Archimboldi, if that seems more resonant and more poignant now, right? There's some kind of truth, having been in Santa Teresa, having seen the kind of vileness of it, having had a certain kind of soul pain, if there's a truth that Pelletier is now able to access in Archimboldi that he wasn't before, and if in fact that detail is maybe more hopeful than we understood at that time, because we now understand kind of the core of something good being in Archimboldi from part 5.
I like that. Yeah, I like that a lot. I definitely, the way we read this, I was kind of thinking more of the connections between part 4 and part 5, but you know, there is that, it makes a lot of sense to like look back on part 1, which is explicitly about Archimboldi as like the object of artistic interest. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I think it also makes, it gives me a way to understand why the novel ends where it ends, because ultimately Archimboldi going to Santa Teresa is the inciting event for at least the reason that part 1 exists. So,
right.
So it does feel circular, right? It's like, okay, now we're, you know, because, you know, another question I have is like why these parts are, I didn't have this on the list, but why these parts are in the order that they're in, you know, and to some extent, I think Archimboldi's story is a key for contextualizing the rest of the novel. But I also secondarily now see it as a circular piece, right? You have Archimboldi going to Santa Teresa, deciding to go to Santa Teresa, and that is our, you know, in part 1, our avenue from the outside world, the outside largely ignorant world, into this incredibly cortisol-soaked society. Like, this is an incredibly stressed and unhealthy, like, city that perpetuates, you know, really bad things, despite, you know, some conscious understanding of what's wrong, even, right? Everyone looks around and it seems like the people who live there, like, have a strong desire to fix all the things that they see are wrong, and yet they can't or won't. And I'm thinking, I owe my friend Hallie actually for the idea of groups of people or a society of people being like a body, and like a body, the stress hormones that affect one body. You can use that as an analogy for understanding how groups of people can become, you know, stuck in a sort of stress, traumatic, fight or flight cycle of bad choices that somehow perpetuate the thing that actually causes them pain. What Hans, like this time through, you said you were like a little less able to protect yourself from part four. What else did you take from this book this last time through? Anything new or anything that complicated your take on 2666 previous?
I don't think so necessarily. I mean, I think that I probably, I think I might have oversimplified a bit in how I remembered it and how I thought about it, right? Or maybe just kind of focused on a narrow aspect of it. I mean, it has a lot going on, right? And there's a lot of stuff happening in it, and there's you can kind of focus it. Obviously, the murders are the main point of interest, I guess, for if that's not too kind of small a word for it, but you can tinker with it quite a lot, right? And I think that I both do and don't feel like I understand it. And I, you know, I mean, I think like my sense of it before was really focused on the thematic resonance between the femicides and the Holocaust, which I do agree is, it takes a certain amount of straining to understand what's going on there. And it's like, if you kind of stop pushing it, you lose the understanding relatively quickly. And I don't know if I can articulate it any better than I did necessarily, right? And I think also probably I it's easy to overread that, right? Because, you know, the Sommer section is certainly something that's very core to Archimboldi's person and history, but ultimately, like, not most of it. It's a kind of digression within the narrative. I don't know that I got anything too different from it this time around, other than just sort of like a lot of small line level, oh, that's clever, oh, that's funny, oh, I like that, combined with a sense, I think, of how it's somehow both one of the most sort of messy and jumbled books that I'm fond of, while also being in certain ways one of the most like completely direct and unjumbled books that I'm fond of, right? It has the combination, I think, of directness and indirectness is not quite like anything that I can think of. Even others, I mean, I've read almost everything else by Bolaño, and it's even very unlike anything else of his in that regard, you know. The lens that I used to talk about it in 2010 was counterhistory, right? The idea that, and this is, I guess, sort of a literary theory, although not one that I remember hearing talked about much, right? The idea of counterhistory is literature functioning as a historical document in a context where the official history is either suspect or non-existent, right? And so if in the real life Juarez, the lack of investigation and accountability meant that there is no kind of official history coming from the state, and the violent suppression of journalism by the cartels meant that there's not really much of an official history coming from journalism. And in the absence of those things, something like part four, it becomes a way of constructing a history and an understanding of what that place and time means and is, that is more valuable for the lack of other kinds of records. And I do think that's one way to think about it, but it's also like 15% of what's happening here, and much of the other 85% is occlusive and strange. It's mm-hmm. I think, necessarily a reductive way to think about it, but still a reductive way to think about it.
I really like that. And I was going to say one thing, but I'll step back to say, like, I really appreciate that idea of counter history. It does feel like this book is This book feels full of very measured, like, kind of rage, at least to me. And like, it's serving a purpose on behalf of that kind of frustrated rage. I was going to say, you know, we talk about this a lot with these big novels, even though we spent a lot more time on this one, you know, even so, like, there are these fragments that feel incredibly meaningful, you know, potentially, like, the Congresswoman's story. She kind of seizes control of the text for a while. There's a little interpolated, you know, sci-fi bit in part five, Kessler, you know, there's these little fragments that feel really, you know, these facets that of the whole that feel rich on their own. Juan de Dios Martinez and his relationship to, Elvira Campos. There's so much, and yet, intense, you know, thematic energy of it feels like it does sort of dominate. I wonder if it would dominate less if we were Mexican, or, you know, even South American, or somehow more closely embedded in, place, the place that, you know, at least the novel circles as a whole, because it does feel, like, some knowledge of place would benefit, benefit appreciating some of those aspects. Patrick, it sounded like for you, it didn't all come together, totally to really like synergize as a novel.
No, I wouldn't say that it didn't click. It didn't quite, there wasn't a moment where I felt like it really came together. But that doesn't mean that I don't see what you guys are saying, and it doesn't mean that I don't believe what you guys are saying either. I just, like, I actually thought maybe I should, like, after hearing what you guys think, I thought maybe I should reread this, even though, you know, I spent a good portion bored. you know, I don't know. These kinds of novels are really hard for me. These big, like, it's not that it's big. I've chosen big novels before, and there are plenty of big novels that I like. It's more like the fact that, like, it's not the same as Against the Day or Underworld, but it's similar in that all those novels have, like, a large cast of characters, and the cast of characters kind of undergo a bunch of different personal things, and most of the time I'm not sure why the personal thing of one character is thematically related to the personal thing of another character. Just these multi-cast novels just rarely do tend to come together for me. So, you know, I think that it's just a shortcoming in myself as a reader, you know, having trouble with pulling in all the threads of sprawling novels to see what's going on. Yeah, that's all I can really say. I'm a bad reader.
No, you're not a bad reader.
I think, what can I say?
Bolaño is like, This is such an interesting text because Bolaño like wanted it to be published, you know, in pieces. And the decision to publish it together is actually really, it feels like such a brave one because like they don't, so much work is being asked, is being demanded of the reader. Mm. You know, it just is, I don't think that it's a, it's not an unfounded criticism that like these pieces don't feel, you wonder like, it's hard not to read this and wonder like, you know, what was kind of going through Bolaño's head when he like, when he decided that this should be published as separate pieces.
Well, that still makes way more sense to me than publishing this as a novel.
Yeah.
I was just going to say like the very first part, felt like a complete novella to me. And I think that was the part that I enjoyed the most. It was the part, where I really felt like there was a thematic purpose. And like I already discussed what I thought that was. And I don't want to say that, like, I know that the other parts have a thematic purpose as well. I just didn't quite see them as clearly. Anyway, yeah, go on, Hans.
Oh, and this is just from the afterword. My understanding is that he wanted them published separately because he wanted his family to be provided for after his death, and he... thought he would, you know, he just thought it would generate more money to publish five books than it wasn't so much an artistic choice as a pragmatic one, right? And I do think personally I find it more interesting as a text, as one big thing with these kind of like uncertain connections than as five small ones. But I mean, it would be, you know, it would be very interesting to consider it, to have experienced those independently too.
No, I'm glad it's all one piece. I just wonder if that pragmatic decision had aesthetic consequences for like the time that he was, you know, alive and thinking about the novel that way in pieces. Did that change like any aspect of like the interstitial tissue that connected them? I don't know. And I don't think that I wouldn't change anything about it. I just, you know, there is so much work that is being asked of the reader, even if it feels, you know, we talked about this with, The Garden of Seven Twilights, where, I can't remember the author's name, forgive me, but, he really, signposts this sort of layers of stories within stories that you are sort of diving into and down through as like the one of the key formal decisions that he made about that book. And it feels like, you know, he's really the author of Garden of Seven Twilights not trying to confuse the reader for no good reason. And I feel that in this case too. Like, I don't feel like Bolaño is doing a postmodernist trick, right? This it feels like there is a there in every, you know, instance. But there's still a lot of work that the reader has to do, and I don't begrudge him for that. It also seems like a legitimate, you know, a legitimate bit of criticism that, like, you know, for many people, this is not going to come together. And I think that's a fair point.
It really irritates me that I had to figure out what the meaning of the title was with an afterword that tells me it's a reference to one of his other novels. Come on. That's irritating.
Well,
I mean, yeah.
I don't know if that answers anything, though. It's like,
well, it's actually a super cool idea. Like the, I think the afterword said that 2666 is a reference to a future apocalyptic era in which, like, the violence of our time is like just a sea of forgotten deaths or something like that, which is a super cool idea. Super cool. I just, like, come on, put that in the novel. not that he's not putting the sea of deaths. He's putting the sea of deaths in the novel, but not the explicit reference, I guess.
And ratio 2-0.
Who?
Sorry. My work laptop has a, for accessibility reasons, they made us install screen readers on our work laptop. So every time I bump it, it screen reads the lock screen.
I think we've done it. We've discussed 2666. I'll say that, you know, it's still, I think, kind of, even if it's, if I'm like lobbing criticisms at the end, it's one of those that is like, I think there's an extra level like of, excellent a piece of art can get to where the criticisms that you can lob at it almost sort of fold into its greatness and become a part of its greatness. And for me, that's 2666. Like I do think it is one of the more important, interesting, like things written in my lifetime. And I was very happy to read it and discuss it with you guys.
You mentioned, Chris, I think your phrase was suppressed rage. You said something about rage. I forget how the what adjective you conditioned the rage with. Channeled rage.
Channeled rage, yeah.
It's, I think the combination here of simple and deeply felt rage and an incredibly obscure artistic purpose, purpose is maybe the wrong word, but a deeply felt and true rage somehow channeled into a very obscure artistic aesthetic, right, is very distinct. It does, I think Pynchon's probably the closest analogy I can think of, not necessarily in that this is Pynchon-esque line by line, because in many ways it's not, right? But I think just kind of that particular odd mixture of artistically obscure of a kind of obscurity of method and a rage and a simplicity of rage driving the work. Maybe it's like something that's actually very characteristic of, it's characteristic of a lot of authors that are described as postmodern, that I think that term is maybe a misfit, right? Pynchon, William Gaddis is another one, a kind of that combination of rage and obscurity. It's sort of like a category of thing that I have always been very attracted to, while understanding that I think it's perfectly reasonable to A, to not like this, and B, to feel like it could be more effective if it were more conventionally focused.
All right. Who's next? And what's next?
I do believe it's next. I always remember California Highway Patrol, Chris Hanspatrick.
Oh,
that's how I've begun remembering who goes in what order. So the, I don't know if either of you encountered any criticism of this or discussion of this, but the letters, combined letters of John Updike were recently published. which led to a certain number of think pieces in various outlets about how Updike is, of the kind of true greats of his generation, maybe the most unappreciated among folks our age in our time. And so that seemed to me like a good opportunity to return to some Updike. And in particular, I wanted to read Couples, which is, I believe, the novel that landed him on the cover of Time magazine, really the thing that turned him into a grade A superstar. And probably also, I would imagine, now an exceptionally dated artifact. So that's my choice, Couples by John Updike.
Awesome. Well, join us next episode for Couples by John Updike. And thank you so much for going on this journey with us, listeners, on discussing 2666 over the course of three episodes. And see you next time.